What is it?
I know everything there is to know, I said through my tears. I know too goddamn much if you want to know the truth. I'm supposed to electrocute John Coffey in less than a week's time, but it was William Wharton who killed the Dederick girls. It was Wild Bill. Chapter 5. The next day, the same bunch of screws who had eaten lunch in my kitchen after the botched Delacroix execution ate lunch there again. This time there was a fifth at our council of war, my wife. It was Jan who convinced me to tell the others. My first impulse had been not to. Wasn't it bad enough, I asked her, that we knew?
You're not thinking clear about it, she'd answered, probably because you're still upset. They already know the worst thing, that John's on the spot for a crime he didn't commit. If anything, this makes it a little better.
I wasn't so sure, but I deferred to her judgment. I expected an uproar when I told Brutal, Dean, and Harry what I knew. I couldn't prove it, but I knew, all right. But at first there was only thoughtful silence. Then, taking another of Janice's biscuits and beginning to put an outrageous amount of butter on it, Dean said, "Did John see him, do you think? Did he see Wharton drop the girls, maybe even rape them?" "I think if he'd seen that, he would have tried to stop it," I said. "As for seeing Wharton, maybe as he ran off, I suppose he might have. If he did, he forgot it later."
"Sure," Dean said. "He's special, but that doesn't make him bright. He only found out it was Wharton when Wharton reached through the bars of his cell and touched him."
Brutal was nodding. That's why John looked so surprised, so shocked. Remember the way his eyes opened? I nodded. "He used Percy on Wharton like a gun. That was what Janice said, and it was what I kept thinking about. Why would John Coffey want to kill Wild Bill? Percy, maybe. Percy stamped on Delacroix's mouse right in front of him. Percy burned Delacroix alive, and John knew it. But Wharton? Wharton messed with most of us in one way or another, but he didn't mess with John at all, so far as I know. Hardly passed 4 dozen words with him the whole time they were on the mile together, and half of those were that last night.
Why would he want to?
He was from Purdom County, and as far as white boys from up there are concerned, you don't even see a Negro unless he happens to step into your road. So why did he do it? What could he have seen or felt when Wharton touched him that was so bad that he saved back the poison he took out of Melly's body? And half killed himself doing it, too, Brutal said. More like 3/4. And the Dederick twins were all I could think of that was bad enough to explain what he did. I told myself the idea was nuts. Too much of a coincidence. It just couldn't be. Then I remembered something Curtis Anderson wrote in the first memo I ever got about Wharton, that Wharton was crazy wild, and that he'd rambled all over the state before the holdup where he killed all those people. Rambled all over the state. That stuck with me. Then there was the way he tried to choke Dean when he came in. That got me thinking about the dog, Dean said. He was rubbing his neck where Wharton had wrapped the chain. I don't think he even knew he was doing it. How the dog's neck was broken. Anyway, I went on up to Purdom County to check Wharton's court records. All we had here were the reports on the murders that got him to the Green Mile. The end of his career, in other words. I wanted the beginning.
A lot of trouble? Brutal asked.
Yeah. Vandalism, petty theft, setting haystack fires. Even theft of an explosive, he and a friend swiped a stick of dynamite and set it off down by a creek. He got going early, 10 years old. But what I wanted wasn't there. Then the sheriff turned up to see who I was and what I was doing, and that was actually lucky. I fibbed, told him that a cell search had turned up a bunch of pictures in Wharton's mattress, little girls with no clothes on. I said I'd wanted to see if Wharton had any kind of history as a pederast, because there were a couple of unsolved cases up in Tennessee that I'd heard about. I was careful never to mention the Dederick twins. I don't think they crossed his mind either.
"Course not," Harry said. "Why would they have? That case is solved, after all."
I said I guess there was no sense chasing the idea, since there was nothing in Wharton's back file. I mean, there was plenty in the file, but none of it about that sort of thing. Then the sheriff, Catlett, his name is, laughed and said not everything a bad apple like Bill Wharton did was in the court files, and what did it matter anyway? He was dead, wasn't he? I said I was doing it just to satisfy my own curiosity, nothing else. and that relaxed him. He took me back to his office, sat me down, gave me a cup of coffee and a sinker, and told me that 16 months ago, when Wharton was barely 18, a man in the western part of the county caught him in the barn with his daughter. It wasn't rape, exactly. The fellow described it to Catlett as not much more than stink finger. Sorry, honey.
That's all right, Janice said. She looked pale, though.
How old was the girl? Brutal asked.
9, I said.
He winced. The man might have taken off after Wharton himself if he'd had him some big old brothers or cousins to give him a help, but he didn't. So he went to Catlett, but made it clear he only wanted Wharton warned. No one wants a nasty thing like that right out in public if it can be helped. Anyway, Sheriff C. had been dealing with Wharton's antics for quite some time, had him in the reform school up that way for 8 months or so when Wharton was 15, and he decided enough was enough. He got 3 deputies. They went out to the Wharton place, set Mrs. Wharton aside when she started to weep and wail, and then they warned Mr. William Billy the Kid Wharton what happens to big pimple-faced galoots who go up in the hayloft with girls not even old enough to have heard about their monthly courses, let alone started them. We warned that little punk good, Catlett told me. Warned him until his head was bleeding, his shoulder was dislocated, and his ass was damn near broke. Brutal was laughing in spite of himself. That sounds like Purdom County, all right, he said, like as not. It was 3 months later, give or take, that Wharton broke out and started on the spree that ended with the holdup, I said. That and the murders that got him to us. So he'd had something to do with an underage girl once, Harry said. He took off his glasses, huffed on them, polished them. Why underage? Once isn't exactly a pattern, is it?
A man doesn't do a thing like that just once, my wife said, then pressed her lips together so tight they almost weren't there.
Next, I told them about my visit to Trepingas County. I'd been a lot more frank with Rob McGee. I'd had no choice, really. To this day, I have no idea what sort of story he spun for Mr. Dederick, but the McGee who sat down next to me in the diner seemed to have aged 7 years. In mid-May, about a month before the holdup and the murders which had finished Wharton's short career as an outlaw, Klaus Dederick had painted his barn, and, incidentally, Bowser's doghouse next to it. He hadn't wanted his son crawling around up on a high scaffolding, and the boy had been in school anyway. So he had hired a fella. A nice enough fella. Very quiet. 3 days' work it had been. No, the fella hadn't slept at the house. Dederick wasn't foolish enough to believe that nice and quiet always meant safe, especially nowadays when there's so much dust bowl riffraff on the roads, a man with a family had to be careful. In any case, the man hadn't needed lodging. He told Dederick he had taken a room in town at Ava Price's. There was a lady named Ava Price in Tefton, and she did rent rooms, but she hadn't had a boarder that May who fit the description of Dederick's hired man, just the usual fellows in checked suits and derby hats hauling sample cases, drummers, in other words. McGee had been able to tell me that because he stopped at Mrs. Price's and checked on his way back from the Dederick farm. That's how upset he was.
Even so, he added, there's no law against a man sleeping rough in the woods, Mr. Edgecombe. I've done it a time or two myself.
The hired man didn't sleep at the Dederick's house, but he took dinner with them twice. He would have met Howie. He would have met the girls, Cora and Kathy. He would have listened to their chatter, some of which might have been about how much they looked forward to the coming summer, because if they were good and the weather was good, Mommy sometimes let them sleep out on the porch, where they could pretend they were pioneer wives crossing the Great Plains in Conestoga wagons. I can see him sitting there at the table, eating roast chicken and Mrs. Dederick's rye bread, listening, keeping his wolf's eyes well veiled, nodding, smiling a little, storing it all up.
This doesn't sound like the wild man you told me about when he first came on the mile, Paul, Janice said doubtfully. Not a bit.
You didn't see him up at Indianola Hospital, ma'am, Harry said, just standing there with his mouth open and his bare butt hanging out the back of his johnny, letting us dress him. We thought he was either drugged or foolish, didn't we, Dean?
Dean nodded. The day after he finished the barn and left, a man wearing a bandana mask robbed Hampi's freight office in Jarvis, I told them. Got away with $70. He also took an 1892 silver dollar the freight agent carried as a lucky piece. That silver dollar was on Wharton when he was captured, and Jarvis is only 30 miles from Tefton.
So this robber, this wild man, you think he just stopped for 3 days to help Klaus Dedrick paint his barn?
My wife said. Ate dinner with them and said, please pass the peas, just like folks. The scariest thing about men like him is how unpredictable they are, Brutal said. He might have been planning to kill the Dedericks and rifle their house, then changed his mind because a cloud came over the sun at the wrong time or something like. Maybe he just wanted to cool off a little. But most likely, he already had his eye on those two girls and was planning to come back. Do you think, Paul? I nodded. Of course I thought it. And then there's the name he gave Dedrick.
What name? Jan asked.
Will Bonnie.
Bonnie? I don't... It was Billy the Kid's real name.
Oh. Then her eyes widened.
Oh! So you can get John Coffey off. Thank God! All you have to do is show Mr. Dedrick a picture of William Wharton. His mugshot should do.
Brutal and I exchanged an uncomfortable look. Dean was looking a bit hopeful, but Harry was staring down at his hands, as if all at once fabulously interested in his fingernails.
"What's wrong?" Janice asked. "Why are you looking at each other that way? Surely this man McGee will have to..."
"Rob McGee struck me as a good man, and I think he's a hell of a law officer," I said, "but he swings no weight in Trepingus County. The power there is Sheriff Kribus, and the day he reopens the Dedrick case on the basis of what I was able to find out would be the day it snows in hell."
"But if Wharton was there, if Dedrick can identify a picture of him and they know he was there..."
"Him being there in May doesn't mean he came back and killed those girls in June," Brutal said. He spoke in a low, gentle voice, the way you speak when you're telling someone there's been a death in the family. "On one hand, you've got this fella who helped Klaus Dedrick paint a barn and then went away. Turns out he was committing crimes all over the place, but there's nothing against him for the 3 days in May he was around Tefton. On the other hand, you've got this big Negro, this huge Negro that you found on the riverbank holding two little dead girls, both of them naked, in his arms." He shook his head. "Paul's right, Jan. McGee may have his doubts, but McGee doesn't matter. Kribus is the only one who can reopen the case, and Kribus doesn't want to mess with what he thinks of as a happy ending. It was a nigger, thinks he, and not one of ourn in any case. Beautiful. I'll go up there to Cold Mountain, have me a steak and a draft beer at Mars, and watch him fry, and there's an end to it." Janice listened to all this with a mounting expression of horror on her face, then turned to me.
"But McGee believes it, doesn't he, Paul? I could see it on your face. Deputy McGee knows he arrested the wrong man. Won't he stand up to the sheriff?"
"All he can do by standing up to him is lose his job," I said. "Yes, I think that in his heart he knows it was Wharton. But what he says to himself is that if he keeps his mouth shut and plays the game until Kribus either retires or eats himself to death, he gets the job, and things will be different then. That's what he tells himself to get to sleep, I imagine. And he's probably not so much different from Homer about one thing. He'll tell himself, after all, it's only a Negro. It's not like they're going to burn a white man for it."
"Then you'll have to go to them," Janice said. And my heart turned cold at the decisive, no-doubt-about-it tone of her voice. "Go and tell them what you found out."
"And how should we tell them we found it out, Jan?" Brutal asked her in that same low voice. "Should we tell them about how Wharton grabbed John while we were taking him out of the prison to work a miracle on the warden's wife?"
"No, of course not, but..."
She saw how thin the ice was in that direction and skated in another one.
"Lie, then," she said. She looked defiantly at Brutal, then turned that look on me. It was hot enough to smoke a hole in newspaper, you'd have said.
"Lie," I repeated. "Lie about what?"
"About what got you going. First up to Purdom County and then down to Topanga's. Go down there to that fat old Sheriff Kribus and say that Wharton told you he raped and murdered the Dederick girls, that he confessed. She switched her hot gaze to Brutal for a moment. You can back him up, Brutus. You can say you were there when he confessed. You heard it, too. Why, Percy probably heard it as well, and that was probably what set him off. He shot Wharton because he couldn't stand thinking of what Wharton had done to those children. It snapped his mind. Just... what? What now, in the name of God?
It wasn't just me and Brutal. Harry and Dean were looking at her, too, with a kind of horror.
We never reported anything like that, ma'am, Harry said. He spoke as if talking to a child. The first thing people would ask is why we didn't. We're supposed to report anything our cell babies say about prior crimes, theirs or anyone else's.
Not that we would have believed him, Brutal put in.
A man like Wild Bill Wharton lies about anything, Jan. Crimes he's committed, big shots he's known, women he's gone to bed with, touchdowns he scored in high school, even the damn weather.
But... Her face was agonized. I went to put my arm around her, and she pushed it violently away.
But he was there. He painted their goddamned barn. He ate dinner with them.
All the more reason why he might take credit for the crime, Brutal said. After all, what harm? Why not boast? You can't fry a man twice after all.
Let me see if I've got this right. We here at this table know that not only did John Coffey not kill those girls, he was trying to save their lives. Deputy McGee doesn't know all that, of course, but he does have a pretty good idea that the man condemned to die for the murders didn't do them. And still, you can't get him a new trial. Can't even reopen the case.
Yes'm, Dean said. He was polishing his glasses furiously. That's about the size of it. She sat with her head lowered, thinking. Brutal started to say something, and I raised a hand, shushing him. I didn't believe Janice could think of a way to get John out of the killing box he was in, but I didn't believe it was impossible, either. She was a fearsomely smart lady, my wife. Fearsomely determined, as well. That's a combination that sometimes turns mountains into valleys.
All right, she said at last. Then you've got to get him out on your own.
Ma'am? Harry looked flabbergasted. Frightened, too.
You can do it. You did it once, didn't you? You can do it again. Only this time you won't bring him back.
Would you want to be the one to explain to my kids why their daddy's in prison, Mrs. Edgecombe? Dean asked, charged with helping a murderer escape jail.
There won't be any of that, Dean. We'll work out a plan, make it look like a real escape.
Make sure it's a plan that could be worked out by a fella who can't even remember how to tie his own shoes, then, Harry said. They'll have to believe that. She looked at him uncertainly.
It wouldn't do any good, Brutal said. Even if we could think of a way, it wouldn't do any good.
Why not? She sounded as if she might be going to cry. Just why the damn hell not?
Because he's a 6'8", bald-headed black man with barely enough brains to feed himself, I said. How long do you think it would be before he was recaptured? 2 hours? 6?
He got along without attracting much attention before, she said.
A tear trickled down her cheek. She slapped it away with the heel of her hand. That much was true. I had written letters to some friends and relatives of mine farther down south asking if they'd seen anything in the papers about a man fitting John Coffey's description, anything at all. Janice had done the same. We had come up with just one possible sighting so far in the town of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. A twister had struck a church there during choir practice in 1929, this had been, and a large black man had hauled two fellows out of the rubble. Both had looked dead to onlookers at first, but as it turned out, neither had been even seriously hurt. It was like a miracle, one of the witnesses was quoted as saying. The black man, a drifter who had been hired by the church pastor to do a day's worth of chores, had disappeared in the excitement.
You're right, he got along, Brutal said. But you have to remember that he did most of his getting along before he was convicted of raping and murdering two little girls.
She sat without answering.
She sat that way for almost a full minute, and then she did something which shocked me as badly as my sudden flow of tears must have shocked her. She reached out and shoved everything off the table with one wide sweep of her arm. Plates, glasses, cups, silverware, the bowl of collards, the bowl of squash, the platter with the carved ham on it, the milk, the pitcher of cold tea, all off the table and onto the floor. Kersmash!
Holy shit! Dean cried, rocking back from the table so hard he damn near went over on his back.
Janice ignored him. It was Brutal and me she was looking at, mostly me.
"Do you mean to kill him, you cowards?" she asked. "Do you mean to kill the man who saved Melinda Moore's life? Who tried to save those little girls' lives? Well, at least there will be one less black man in the world, won't there? You can console yourselves with that. One less nigger!"
She got up, looked at her chair, and kicked it into the wall. It rebounded and fell into the spilled squash. I took her wrist, and she yanked it free.
"Don't touch me!" she said. Next week this time you'll be a murderer, no better than that man Wharton, so don't touch me!
She went out onto the back stoop, put her apron up to her face, and began to sob into it. The four of us looked at each other. After a little bit, I got on my feet and set about cleaning up the mess. Brutal joined me first, then Harry and Dean. When the place looked more or less shipshape again, they left. None of us said a word the whole time. There was really nothing left to say. Chapter 6 That was my night off. I sat in the living room of our little house, smoking cigarettes, listening to the radio, and watching the dark come up out of the ground to swallow the sky. Television is all right, I've nothing against it, but I don't like how it turns you away from the rest of the world and toward nothing but its own glassy self. In that one way, at least, radio was better. Janice came in, knelt beside the arm of my chair, and took my hand. For a little while, neither of us said anything, just stayed that way, listening to Kay Kaiser's College of Musical Knowledge and watching the stars come out. It was all right with me.
"I'm so sorry I called you a coward," she said. "I feel worse about that than anything I've ever said to you in our whole marriage."
"Even the time when we went camping and you called me Old Stinky Sam?" I asked. And then we laughed and had a kiss or two. And it was better again between us. She was so beautiful, my Janice. And I still dream of her. Old and tired of living as I am, I'll dream that she walks into my room in this lonely, forgotten place where the hallways all smell of piss and old boiled cabbage. I dream she's young and beautiful with her blue eyes and her fine high breasts that I couldn't hardly keep my hands off of, and she'll say, "Why, honey, I wasn't in that bus crash. You made a mistake, that's all." Even now I dream that. And sometimes when I wake up and know it was a dream, I cry. Who hardly ever cried at all when I was young. "Does Hal know?" she asked at last. "That John's innocent? I don't see how he can."
"Can he help? Does he have any influence with Cribus?"
"Not a bit, honey." She nodded as if she had expected this.
"Then don't tell him. If he can't help, for God's sake, don't tell him."
"No." She looked up at me with steady eyes.
"And you won't call in sick that night. None of you will. You can't."
"No, we can't. If we're there, we can at least make it quick for him. We can do that much. It won't be like Delacroix." For a moment, mercifully brief, I saw the black silk mask burning away from Del's face and revealing the cooked blobs of jelly which had been his eyes.
"There's no way out for you, is there?"
She took my hand,
rubbed it down the soft velvet of her cheek.
Poor Paul. Poor old guy.
I said nothing. Never before or after in my life did I feel so much like running from a thing, just taking Jan with me, the two of us with a single packed carpet bag between us, running to anywhere.
My poor old guy, she repeated. And then, talk to him.
Who, John?
Yes. Talk to him. Find out what he wants.
I thought about it, then nodded. She was right. She usually was. Chapter 7 2 days later, on the 18th, Bill Dodge, Hank Bitterman, and someone else, I don't remember who, some floater, took John Coffey over to D Block for his shower. And we rehearsed his execution while he was gone. We didn't let Toot Toot stand in for John. All of us knew, even without talking about it, that it would have been an obscenity. I did it. John Coffey, Brutal said in a not-quite-steady voice as I sat clamped into old Sparky. You have been condemned to die in the electric chair. Sentence passed by a jury of your peers. John Coffey's peers? What a joke. So far as I knew, there was no one like him on the planet. Then I thought of what John had said while he stood looking at Sparky from the foot of the stairs leading down from my office.
They're still in there. I hear 'em screaming.
Get me out of it, I said hoarsely. Undo these clamps and let me up. They did it, but for a moment I felt frozen there, as if old Sparky did not want to let me go. As we walked back to the block, Brutal spoke to me in a low voice, so not even Dean and Harry, who were setting up the last of the chairs behind us, would overhear. I've done a few things in my life that I'm not proud of, but this is the first time I ever felt really actually in danger of hell. I looked at him to make sure he wasn't joking. I didn't think he was. What do you mean?
I mean we're fixing to kill a gift of God, he said. One that never did any harm to us or to anyone else. What am I going to say if I end up standing in front of God the Father Almighty and he asks me to explain why I did it, that it was my job? My job?
Chapter 8 When John got back from his shower and the floaters had left, I unlocked his cell, went in, and sat down on the bunk beside him. Brutal was on the desk. He looked up, saw me in there on my own, but said nothing. He just went back to whatever paperwork he was currently mangling, licking away at the tip of his pencil the whole time. John looked at me with his strange eyes, bloodshot, distant, on the verge of tears, and yet calm, too, as if crying was not such a bad way of life, not once you got used to it. He even smiled a little. He smelled of ivory soap, I remember, as clean and fresh as a baby after his evening bath.
"Hello, boss," he said,
and then reached out and took both of my hands in both of his. It was done with a perfect, unstudied naturalness. "Hello, John?" There was a little block in my throat, and I tried to swallow it away. "I guess you know that we're coming down to it now. Another couple of days." He said nothing, only sat there holding my hands in his. I think, looking back on it, that something had already begun to happen to me, but I was too fixed, mentally and emotionally, on doing my duty to notice. Is there anything special you'd like that night for dinner, John? We can rustle you up most anything. Even bring you a beer if you want. Just have to put it in a coffee cup, that's all.
Never got the taste, he said. Something special to eat, then?
His brow creased below that expanse of clean brown skull, then the line smoothed out and he smiled.
Meatloaf'd be good.
Meatloaf it is, with gravy and mashed. I felt a tingle, like you get in your arm when you've slept on it, except this one was all over my body. In my body.
What else to go with it? Dunno, boss. Whatever you got, I guess. Okra, maybe, but I's not picky.
All right, I said, and thought he would also have Mrs. Janice Edgecombe's peach cobbler for dessert. Now, what about a preacher? Someone you could say a little prayer with night after next. It comforts a man. I've seen that many times. I could get in touch with Reverend Schuster. He's a man who came when Dell don't want no preacher, John said.
You been good to me, boss. You can say a prayer if you want. That'd be all right. I could get knee bound with you a bit, I guess.
Me? John, I couldn't. He pressed down on my hands a little, and that feeling got stronger.
You could, he said. Couldn't you, boss?
I suppose so, I heard myself say. My voice seemed to have developed an echo. I suppose I could, if it came to that. The feeling was strong inside me by then, and it was like before when he'd cured my waterworks, but it was different, too. And not just because there was nothing wrong with me this time. It was different because this time he didn't know he was doing it. Suddenly I was terrified, almost choked with a need to get out of there. Lights were going on inside me where there had never been lights before, not just in my brain, all over my body.
You and Mr. Howell and the other boss has been good to me, John Coffey said. I know you've been worrying, but you ought to quit on it now. Because I want to go, boss.
I tried to speak, and couldn't. He could, though. What he said next was the longest I ever heard him speak.
I'm rightly tired of the pain I hear and feel, boss. I'm tired of being on the road, lonely as a robin in the rain, not never having nobody to go on with, or tell me where we's coming from, or going to, or why. I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. It feels like pieces of glass in my head. I'm tired of all the times I wanted to help and couldn't. I'm tired of being in the dark. Mostly, it's the pain. There's too much. If I could end it, I would. But I can't.
Stop it, I tried to say. Stop it. Let go of my hands. I'm going to drown if you don't. Drown or explode.
You won't explode, he said, smiling a little at the idea.
But he let go of my hands. I leaned forward, gasping. Between my knees, I could see every crack in the cement floor, every groove, every flash of mica. I looked up at the wall and saw names that had been written there in 1924, 1926, 1931. Those names had been washed away. The men who had written them had also been washed away, in a manner of speaking. But I guess you can never wash anything completely away, not from this dark glass of a world. And now I saw them again, a tangle of names overlying one another, and looking at them was like listening to the dead speak and sing and cry out for mercy. I felt my eyeballs pulsing in their sockets, heard my own heart, felt the windy whoosh of my blood rushing through all the boulevards of my body like letters being mailed to everywhere. I heard a train whistle in the distance, the 350 to Priceford, I imagine, but I couldn't be sure because I'd never heard it before. Not from Cold Mountain, I hadn't, because the closest it came to the state pen was 10 miles east. I couldn't have heard it from the pen, so you would have said, and so until November of 32 I would have believed, but I heard it that day. Somewhere a light bulb shattered, loud as a bomb.
"What did you do to me?" I whispered. "Oh, John, what did you do?"
"I'm sorry, boss," he said in his calm way. "I wasn't thinking. Ain't much, I reckon. You feel like regular soon."
I got up and went to the cell door. It felt like walking in a dream. When I got there, he said,
"You wonder why they didn't scream. That's the only thing you still wonder about, ain't it? Why those two little girls didn't scream while they were still there on the porch?"
I turned and looked at him. I could see every red snap in his eyes. I could see every pore on his face. And I could feel his hurt, the pain that he took in from other people like a sponge takes in water. I could see the darkness he had spoken of, too. It lay in all the spaces of the world as he saw it. And in that moment I felt both pity for him and great relief. Yes, it was a terrible thing we'd be doing. Nothing would ever change that. And yet we would be doing him a favor.
I seen it when that bad fella he done grabbed me, John said. That's when I knowed it was him done it. I seen him that day. I was in the trees, and I seen him drop them down and run away. But
you forgot, I said.
That's right, boss. Until he touched me, I forgot.
Why didn't they scream, John? He hurt them enough to make them bleed. Their parents were right upstairs, so why didn't they scream? John looked at me from his haunted eyes.
He say to the one, if you make noise, it's your sister I kill, not you. He say that same to the other. You see?
Yes, I whispered. And I could see it. The Dederick porch in the dark. Wharton leaning over them like a ghoul. One of them had maybe started to cry out, so Wharton had hit her, and she had bled from the nose. That's where most of it had come from.
He killed them with their love, John said. Their love for each other. You see how it was?
I nodded, incapable of speech. He smiled. The tears were flowing again, but he smiled.
That's how it is every day, he said, all over the world.
Then he lay down and turned his face to the wall. I stepped out onto the mile, locked his cell, and walked up to the duty desk. I still felt like a man in a dream. I realized I could hear Brutal's thoughts. A very faint whisper, how to spell some word, receive, I think it was. He was thinking, I before E except after C, is that how the dad-ratted thing goes? Then he looked up, started to smile, and stopped when he got a good look at me. Paul, he asked, are you all right? Yes. Then I told him what John had told me. Not all of it, and certainly not about what his touch had done to me. I never told anyone that part, not even Janice. Elaine Connolly will be the first to know of it, if that is she wants to read these last pages after reading all the rest of them. But I repeated what John had said about wanting to go. That seemed to relieve Brutal, a bit, anyway, but I sensed, heard him wondering if I hadn't made it up just to set his mind at ease. Then I felt him deciding to believe it, simply because it would make things a little easier for him when the time came. Paul, is that infection of yours coming back? He asked. You look all flushed. No, I think I'm okay, I said. I wasn't, but I felt sure by then that John was right and I was going to be. I could feel that tingle starting to subside.
All the same, it might not hurt you to go on in your office there and lie down a bit.
Lying down was the last thing I felt like right then. The idea seemed so ridiculous that I almost laughed. What I felt like doing was maybe building myself a little house, then shingling it and plowing a garden in back and planting it, all before supper time. That's how it is, I thought, every day, all over the world. That darkness, all over the world. I'm gonna take a turn over to admin instead. Got a few things to check over there.
If you say so.
I went to the door and opened it, then looked back. You've got it right, I said. I before E, except after C. Most of the time, anyway. I guess there's exceptions to all the rules. I went out, not needing to look back at him to know he was staring with his mouth open. I kept moving for the rest of that shift, unable to sit down for more than 5 minutes at a stretch before jumping up again.
I went over to admin, and then I tromped back and forth across the empty exercise yard until the guards in the towers must have thought I was crazy. But by the time my shift was over, I was starting to calm down again, and that rustle of thoughts in my head, like a stirring of leaves it was, had pretty much quieted down. Still, halfway home that morning, it came back strong. I had to park my Ford by the side of the road, get out, and sprint nearly half a mile, head down, arms pumping, breath tearing in and out of my throat as warm as something that you've carried in your armpit. Then, at last, I began to feel really normal. I trotted halfway back to where the Ford was parked and walked the rest of the way, my breath steaming in the chilly air. When I got home, I told Janice that John Coffey had said he was ready, that he wanted to go. She nodded, looking relieved. Was she, really? I couldn't say. 6 hours before, even three, I would have known, but by then I didn't. And that was good. John had kept saying that he was tired, and now I could understand why. It would have tired anyone out, what he had. Would have made anyone long for rest and for quiet. When Janice asked me why I looked so flushed and smelled so sweaty, I told her I had stopped the car on my way home and gone running for a while, running hard. I told her that much. As I may have said, there's too many pages here now for me to want to look back through and make sure lying wasn't much a part of our marriage. But I didn't tell her why. And she didn't ask. Chapter 9. There were no thunderstorms on the night it came John Coffey's turn to walk the Green Mile. It was seasonably cold for those parts at that time of year, in the 30s, I'd guess, and a million stars spilled across used-up, picked-out fields where frost glittered on fence posts and glowed like diamonds on the dry skeletons of July's corn. Brutus Howell was out front for this one. He would do the capping and tell Van Hay to roll when it was time. Bill Dodge was in with Van Hay. And at around 11:20 on the night of November 20th, Dean and Harry and I went down to our one occupied cell, where John Coffey sat on the end of his bunk with his hands clasped between his knees and a tiny dab of meatloaf gravy on the collar of his blue shirt. He looked out through the bars at us. A lot calmer than we felt, it seemed. My hands were cold and my temples were throbbing. It was one thing to know he was willing. It made it at least possible for us to do our job. But it was another to know we were going to electrocute him for someone else's crime. I had last seen Hal Moores around 7 that evening. He was in his office, buttoning up his overcoat. His face was pale, his hand shaking so badly that he was making quite some production of those buttons. I almost wanted to knock his fingers aside and do the coat up myself like you would with a little kid. The irony was that Melinda had looked better when Jan and I went to see her the previous weekend than Hal had looked earlier on John Coffey's execution evening. "I won't be staying for this one," he had said. "Curtis will be there, and I know Coffey will be in good hands with you and Brutus." "Yes, sir, we'll do our best," I said. "Is there any word on Percy? Is he coming back around, is what I meant, of course. Is he even now sitting in a room somewhere and telling someone, some doctor most likely, about how we zipped him into the nut coat and threw him into the restraint room like any other problem child? Any other lagoon in Percy's language? And if he is, are they believing him?" But according to Hal, Percy was just the same. Not talking, and not, so far as anyone could tell, in the world at all. He was still at Indianola, being evaluated, Hal had said, looking mystified at the phrase. But if there was no improvement, he would be moving along soon. "How's Coffey holding up?" Hal had asked then. He had finally managed to do up the last button of his coat. I nodded. "He'll be fine, Warden." He'd nodded back, then gone to the door, looking old and ill. How can so much good and so much evil live together in the same man? How could the man who cured my wife be the same man who killed those little girls? Do you understand that? I had told him I didn't, The ways of God were mysterious. There was good and evil in all of us. Ours not to reason why. Hacha hacha rodi do. Most of what I told him were things I'd learned in the Church of Praise Jesus the Lord is Mighty, Hal nodding the whole time and looking sort of exalted. He could afford to nod, couldn't he? Yes, and look exalted, too. There was a deep sadness on his face. He was shaken, all right, I never doubted it, but there were no tears this time, because he had a wife to go home to, his companion to go home to, and she was fine. Thanks to John Coffey, she was well and fine, and the man who had signed John's death warrant could leave and go to her. He didn't have to watch what came next. He would be able to sleep that night in his wife's warmth, while John Coffey lay on a slab in the basement of County Hospital, growing cool as the friendless, speechless hours moved toward dawn. And I hated Hal for those things, just a little, and I'd get over it, but it was hate. All right. The genuine article. Now I stepped into the cell, followed by Dean and Harry, both of them pale and downcast. "Are you ready, John?" I asked. He nodded.
"Yes, boss, guess so."
"All right, then. I got a piece to say before we go out."
"You say what you need to, boss."
"John Coffey... as an officer of the court," I said it right to the end. And when I'd finished, Harry Terwilliger stepped up beside me and held out his hand. John looked surprised for a moment, then smiled and shook it. Dean, looking paler than ever, offered his next.
"You deserve better than this, Johnny," he said hoarsely. "I'm sorry."
"I'll be all right," John said. "This the hard part. I'll be all right in a little while."
He got up, and the St. Christopher's medal Melly had given him swung free of his shirt. "John, I ought to have that," I said. "I can put it back on you after, if you want, but I should take it for now." It was silver, and if it was lying against his skin when Jack Van Hay switched on the juice, it might fuse itself into his skin. Even if it didn't do that, it was apt to electroplate, leaving a kind of charred photograph of itself on the skin of his chest. I had seen it before. I'd seen most everything during my years on the Mile. More than was good for me, I knew that now. He slipped the chain over his head and put it in my hand. I put the medallion in my pocket and told him to step on out of the cell. There was no need to check his head and make sure the contact would be firm and the induction good. It was as smooth as the palm of my hand.
"You know I fell asleep this afternoon and had a dream, boss," he said. "I dreamed about Dell's mouse."
"Did you, John?" I flanked him on the left. Harry took the right. Dean fell in behind, and then we were walking the Green Mile. For me, it was the last time I ever walked it with a prisoner.
"Yep," he said. "I dreamed he got down to that place Boss Howe talked about, that Mouseville place. I dreamed there was kids, and how they laughed at his tricks. My!"
He laughed himself at the thought of it, then grew serious again.
"I dreamed those two little blonde-headed girls were there. They's laughing, too. I put my arms around them, and there's no blood coming out their hair, and they's fine. We all watch Mr. Jingles roll that spool, and how we did laugh. Fit to bust, we was."
"Is that so?" I was thinking I couldn't go through with it. Just could not. There was no way. I was going to cry or scream, or maybe my heart would burst with sorrow, and that would be an end to it. We went into my office. John looked around for a moment or two, then dropped to his knees without having to be asked. Behind him, Harry was looking at me with haunted eyes. Dean was as white as paper. I got down on my knees with John and thought there was a funny turnaround brewing here. After all the prisoners I'd had to help up so they could finish the journey, this time I was the one who was apt to need a hand. That's the way it felt, anyway.
"What should we pray for, boss?" John asked.
"Strength," I said without even thinking. I closed my eyes and said, "Lord God of hosts, please help us finish what we've started, and please welcome this man, John Coffey, like the drink, but not spelled the same, into heaven, and give him peace. Please help us to see him off the way he deserves, and let nothing go wrong. Amen. I opened my eyes and looked at Dean and Harry. Both of them looked a little better. Probably it was having a few moments to catch their breath. I doubt it was my praying. I started to get up, and John caught my arm. He gave me a look that was both timid and hopeful.
"I remember a prayer someone taught me when I was little," he said. "At least I think I do. Can I say it?"
"You go right on and do her," Dean said. "Lots of time yet, John." John closed his eyes and frowned with concentration. I expected now I lay me down to sleep, or maybe a garbled version of the Lord's Prayer, but I got neither. I had never heard what he came out with before, and have never heard it again. Not that either the sentiments or expressions were particularly unusual. Holding his hands up in front of his closed eyes, John Coffey said,
"Baby Jesus, meek and mild, pray for me, an orphan child. Be my strength, be my friend, be with me until the end. Amen."
He opened his eyes, started to get up, then looked at me closely. I wiped my arm across my eyes. As I listened to him, I had been thinking about Dell. He had wanted to pray one more at the end, too. "Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death."
"Sorry, John." "Don't be," he said. He squeezed my arm and smiled. And then, as I'd thought he might have to do, he helped me to my feet.
Chapter 10. There weren't many witnesses, maybe 14 in all, half the number that had been in the storage room for the Delacroix execution. Homer Cribus was there, overflowing his chair, as per usual, but I didn't see Deputy McGee. Like Warden Moores, he had apparently decided to give this one a miss. Sitting in the front row was an elderly couple I didn't recognize at first, even though I had seen their pictures in a good many newspaper articles by that day in the third week of November. Then, as we neared the platform where old Sparky waited, the woman spat,
"Die slow, you son of a bitch!"
And I realized they were the Dettericks, Klaus and Marjorie. I hadn't recognized them because you don't often see elderly people who haven't yet climbed out of their 30s. John hunched his shoulders at the sound of the woman's voice and Sheriff Cribus's grunt of approval. Hank Bitterman, who had the guard post near the front of the meager group of spectators, never took his eyes off Klaus Dettrick. That was per my orders, but Dettrick never made a move in John's direction that night. Dettrick seemed to be on some other planet. Brutal, standing beside old Sparky, gave me a small finger tilt as we stepped up onto the platform. He holstered his sidearm and took John's wrist, escorting him toward the electric chair as gently as a boy leading his date out onto the floor for their first dance as a couple.
"Everything all right, John?" he asked in a low voice.
"Yes, boss, but..."
His eyes were moving from side to side in their sockets, and for the first time he looked and sounded scared.
"But days a lot of folks here hate me. A lot. I can feel it. Hurts. Bores in like bee stings and hurts."
"Feel how we feel, then," he said in that same low voice. "We don't hate you. Can you feel that?"
"Yes, boss."
But his voice was trembling worse now, and his eyes had begun to leak their slow tears again.
"Kill him twice, you boys!"
Marjorie Dettrick suddenly screamed. Her ragged, strident voice was like a slap. John cringed against me and moaned.
"You go on and kill that raping baby killer twice. That'll be just fine."
Klaus, still looking like a man dreaming awake, pulled her against his shoulder. She began to sob. I saw with dismay that Harry Terwilliger was crying, too. So far, none of the spectators had seen his tears. His back was to them, but he was crying, all right. Still, what could we do? Besides push on with it, I mean. Brutal and I turned John around. Brutal pressed on one of the big man's shoulders, and John sat. He gripped Sparky's wide oak arms, his eyes moving from side to side, his tongue darting out to wet first one corner of his mouth, then the other. Harry and I dropped to our knees. The day before, we'd had one of the shop trustees weld temporary flexible extensions to the chair's ankle clamps, because John Coffey's ankles were nigh on the size of an ordinary fellow's calves. Still, I had a nightmarish moment when I thought they were still going to come up small, and we'd have to take him back to his cell, while Sam Broderick, who was head of the shop guys in those days, was found and tinkered some more. I gave a final extra-hard shove with the heels of my hands, and the clamp on my side closed. John's leg jerked, and he gasped. I had pinched him. "Sorry, John," I murmured and glanced at Harry. He had gotten his clamp fixed more easily. Either the extension on his side was a little bigger, or John's right calf was a little smaller. But he was looking at the result with a doubtful expression. I guessed I could understand why. The modified clamps had a hungry look, their jaws seeming to gape like the mouths of alligators. "It'll be all right," I said, hoping that I sounded convincing, and that I was telling the truth. "Wipe your face, Harry." He swabbed at it with his arm, wiping away tears from his cheeks and beads of sweat from his forehead. We turned. Homer Kribus, who had been talking too loudly to the man sitting next to him, the prosecutor, judging from the string tie and rusty black suit, fell silent. It was almost time. Brutal had clamped one of John's wrists, Dean the other. Over Dean's shoulder I could see the doctor, unobtrusive as ever, standing against the wall with his black bag between his feet. Nowadays I guess they just about run such affairs, especially the ones with the IV drips. But back then you almost had to yank them forward if you wanted them. Maybe back then they had a clearer idea of what was right for a doctor to be doing and what was a perversion of the special promise they make, the one where they swear first of all to do no harm. Dean nodded to Brutal. Brutal turned his head, seemed to glance at the telephone that was never going to ring for the likes of John Coffey, and called, "Roll on one," to Jack Van Hay. There was that hum, like an old fridge kicking on, and the lights burned a little brighter. Our shadows stood out a little sharper, black shapes that climbed the wall and seemed to hover around the shadow of the chair like vultures. John drew in a sharp breath. His knuckles were white.
"Does it hurt yet?"
Mrs. Dederick shrieked brokenly from against her husband's shoulder.
"I hope it does. I hope it hurts like hell."
Her husband squeezed her. One side of his nose was bleeding, I saw, a narrow trickle of red working its way down into his narrow gauge mustache. When I opened the paper the following March and saw he'd died of a stroke, I was about the least surprised man on earth. Brutal stepped into John's field of vision. He touched John's shoulder as he spoke. That was irregular, but of the witnesses, only Curtis Anderson knew it, and he did not seem to remark it. I thought he looked like a man who only wants to be done with his current job, desperately wants to be done with it. He enlisted in the Army after Pearl Harbor, but never got overseas. He died at Fort Bragg in a truck accident. John, meanwhile, relaxed beneath Brutal's fingers. I don't think he understood much, if any, of what Brutal was telling him, but he took comfort from Brutal's hand on his shoulder. Brutal, who died of a heart attack about 25 years later, he was eating a fish sandwich and watching TV wrestling when it happened, his sister said, was a good man. My friend. Maybe the best of us. He had no trouble understanding how a man could simultaneously want to go and still be terrified of the trip. "John Coffey, you have been condemned to die in the electric chair, sentence passed by a jury of your peers and imposed by a judge of good standing in this state. God save the people of this state. Do you have anything to say before a sentence is carried out?" John wet his lips again, then spoke clearly, 6 words.
"I'm sorry for what I am."
"You ought to be!"
the mother of the two dead girls screamed.
"Oh, you monster! You ought to be! You damn well ought to be!"
John's eyes turned to me. I saw no resignation in them, no hope of heaven, no dawning peace. How I would love to tell you that I did. How I would love to tell myself that. What I saw was